Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Today in Artworks, female flower power, 19th century style. In the 1890s, Ellis Rowan was known across the land as the famous lady flower painter and adventuress. We'll take a look at her floral adventurous life with her latest biographers. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith and this is ABC Radio National. Also coming up in Artworks, we'll hear from three very different performance poets from around the Asia Pacific, including one who's introduced Ned Kelly to Singapore, and the latest instalment of our Isms in Art series for you as well. The Flower Hunter is the name of a book by Ellis Rowan, published in 1898. It's also the title of a new biography of her by Christine and Michael Morton Evans. In the latter part of the 19th century and through to her death in 1922, Ellis Rowan was a household name in Australia. And although she's pretty well forgotten now, her story is one of a quite remarkable artistic and adventurous life. She spent the whole of it doing paintings of flowers, but as Christine Morton Evans says, she was very different from the usual lady flower painter.
She was no drawing room dauber, unlike the other lady flower painters of her time, who would really just look no further probably than their own garden or possibly the local market for their specimens. Ellis wasn't interested in that sort of painting. She actually literally went out to hunt. That's why she called herself the flower hunter, because that's basically what she did. It was just as important to her, the exploration part, the hunting, the finding flowers, particularly the rare and the exotic. And to do so, she travelled far and wide in Australia and beyond to the most remote and inhospitable terrain.
Well, she was self-taught as a painter, and in her own lifetime and ever since, really, there has been debate about the artistic merit of her painting. The most telling moment, I think, comes in 1888 when she exhibits paintings at the Centennial International Exhibition. This is at the exhibition buildings in Melbourne. And one of her paintings wins the gold medal for best in show, and she beats the likes of Tom Roberts and Frederick McCubbin here, which prompts a letter of protest. Michael, tell us the story.
Well, that was a furore and a half. She'd beaten all the male artists of the day to the top prize. And we're talking about Louis Buvelot, Eugene von Gerard, Julian Ashton, as well as the younger up-and-coming artists like Tom Roberts and Fred McCubbin. And here was this flower painter. Use the word, you know, in its derogatory term. She was a mere flower painter. And she'd beaten them to the first prize.
So why the letter of protest? Why did those male painters of the day protest? Was it just that she was just a flower painter, or was there more to it than that?
Well, we'll never really know. I think it's reasonable to speculate that the green-eyed god of envy played a part. And I think the male artists were furious that the public preferred to hang what they thought of as merely decorative art on their walls in preference to their own work, which they considered to be high art.
And real painters were men.
Oh, of course, of course, yes. I mean, as Christine said, I mean, ladies who were properly brought up at the time stayed in the drawing room. They certainly didn't go scrambling around in, you know, snake-infested jungles with their, you know, showing their bloomers.
Well, Christine, what was Ellis Rowan's ambition? What was her goal as a painter?
Well, her goal, her aim was to paint an entire collection of Australia's rarest and most exotic flora. The idea came to her after a meeting with Marion North in Western Australia in 1880.
This is the English botanical artist, Marion North.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Who herself set out to, I mean, with an even bigger goal, to paint the flowers of the world. Ellis, at least, was prepared to settle for a little bit less and said, I'll settle for Australasia. Certainly nobody had done it. But, you know, in the same way as Marion North, she wanted Australians to see the beauty all around them. I think in a way she also set out to dispel the prevailing view at the time of the landscape in Australia, that sort of melancholy idea of the dark and the forbidding, the strange.
And Michael, in the years leading up to Federation, did she see this as a kind of nationalist project?
I don't know the extent to which she actually thought of it quite that way. I think it was more a personal goal to begin with. She actually wanted to get out and prove something, I think, to herself. And it was very much tied up also with another of the key influences in her life, and that was Baron von Müller.
The great botanist and director of the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne.
Yes. Then subsequently became the Victorian government botanist. But when she met him in 1872, he was in the process of writing a book in which he was trying to describe and show drawings of every known Australian flowering plant. And he had for many years been recruiting people to find specimens for him and send them back to him in Melbourne, very nearly 200 men and women around Australia. And when he met Ellis, he thought to himself, here's a good collector for me, you know, I'll add her to the team. But as he got to know her better, he realised that she was, you know, rather special. She was a little bit something other than his normal collectors. And it's said that at one stage he even actually offered to pay to send her to Germany to learn the art of botanical drawing, which she, thank God, turned down.
Because why did she turn it down?
I don't think that, you know, she was suited to that sort of a profession. I mean, without any disrespect to the wonderful botanical artists we have, it's a tad anal. You have to be very, very precise in every little bit of the flower and the stamens and the petals and the...
But it was also about the conditions to undertake the work as a botanical artist meant she was going to be stuck inside working for someone. She was not going to have the freedom to roam as she needed to. She was a very restless spirit.
Mm. And what about her scientific merit, though? I mean, we have talked about the debate around the artistic merit of her wildflower paintings. Did she make a contribution to botany?
Well, she certainly did then. Now, of course, I think the bar has been raised significantly in terms of contemporary botanical art. But she very much fell, really, between those two stools of science and art. The scientists disowned her to some extent. You know, she was an artist. She took liberties like the inclusion of a butterfly or, you know, even a snake in a painting or, you know, even sometimes within the flower itself, you know, by not quite as much detail as they would have preferred. But by the same token, the artist said, no, she's too scientific. So one of the problems was she really did fall between those two stools. And I think in a way that was to her detriment. But then on the other hand, you know, Ellis was not the kind of person to have gone and undertaken that study in Germany and locked herself up in a workroom somewhere.
This is Artworks on ABC Radio National. Amanda Smith with you, along with Christine and Michael Morton-Evans, the authors of a biography of the 19th century Australian flower painter and collector and traveller Ellis Rowan. Now, Michael, although Ellis Rowan had a husband and a son, she did spend really most of her adult life going off on her own to remote places in pursuit of plants and painting. She travelled throughout Australia, especially through far north Queensland and Western Australia, as well as New Zealand and America and New Guinea. How did she manage to travel alone as a woman at that time, and also to be able to leave her husband and child?
Well, a lot of her early travelling, of course, she did with her husband. After he left the army, after they got married, he was in the New Zealand Armed Constabulary. And when they were married, she lived for some years with him in New Zealand, which is really where it all started. And he encouraged her, really, to spend her days painting, because she was stuck out there at a place called Pukearawe up on the west coast, and there wasn't much social life. But when they got back to Melbourne, he resigned his commission. They went back to Melbourne. He was very interested. He was a businessman, and he was very interested in electricity. And he very quickly became the manager of a company that produced components that were required to generate electricity. And he travelled around Australia, and she used to travel with him. So while he was at his business meeting, she would be out painting. So for a lot of the time, while he was alive, she did her travelling with him. But it became very much different after Frederick died. He died tragically early at the age of 48. We think of pneumonia. And then it really was going to be difficult, because women travelling alone at that time was, not the done thing. She managed to protect herself to some degree by wearing widow's weeds, which she did pretty well for the rest of her life. That, to some degree, protected her.
She must have cut quite a scene going through the tropics and the bush in full Victorian widow's garb.
Oh, well, if you can imagine, the high-necked collar and the whalebone corsets and the ankle-length dress and the dainty boots with the hat and the parasol and the paintbrushes. Yes, I mean, it was no shorts and sandals for her. But, people obviously did look a bit askance at her, but she had a personality, she had a force of personality that got people eating out of her hand, the most extraordinary people. I mean, she was equally at home with state premiers as she was with sweaty mining prospectors out in places like Goongarry, out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, Christine, apart from the paintings, what records exist of her life and travels and her private thoughts?
Well, I have to say that as far as the private person, it's a bit of a biographer's nightmare, really. She was so intensely private, probably not just her, but I would say that the whole of her family were like that. And there were several scandals in the family's travelling through life. And almost everything that was private was destroyed, either before she died or even at the time of her husband's death. Certainly at the time of her, certainly all the stuff surrounding her child's death in Zimbabwe. But in terms of the public persona, I mean, she absolutely lived up this reputation as the kind of bold, intrepid, unconventional explorer. Those are the things that we consider a rather male virtue, especially of that time. And when Michael was talking about her dress, my idea is that that very ultra-feminine appearance was really her cover in more than one sense of the word. Had her appearance been sort of mannish, perhaps a little bit like Marion North, who was rather mannish, I don't think she would have had half the help from men that she did have. I mean, the fact that she was tiny and looked helpless, she was strong as anything, but she looked really most of her life almost like a child. They fell over themselves to help her.
So was she then a bold adventuress, or was that part of her myth-making around herself?
Oh, I think that, yes, I think she was, because she managed to carve out exactly the kind of life for herself that she wanted to live. And it was a huge achievement at that time. And, she had to risk, obviously, a lot of tutting the Melbourne matrons who disapproved of her particular kind of unusual marriage, even perhaps down to her role as a parent.
Well, Michael, she was also quite entrepreneurial, wasn't she? And she certainly had to be after her husband's death in 1892. He died a bankrupt. She, for example, organised the very first art exhibition that was ever held in Western Australia.
She did more than that, Amanda. She was the first female artist in Australia ever to have an exhibition. She had to make money, yes. It was a great shock to her when she discovered that, in fact, her husband was bankrupt. Apart from her painting, to make money, one of the ways that she did this was by signing contracts with various magazines, like the Australian Town and Country magazine, to write about the places that she was visiting. For example, when she went to New Zealand after her husband's death, she went on a visit back there for a whole year, every week for a whole year. These articles, accompanied by her drawings, her black and white drawings, were published in the Australian Town and Country. And she played them up to no end to make them sound really interesting for her readers. And the trouble is, we don't really quite know which bits of it are entirely true.
But they secured her fame.
Oh, they certainly secured her fame, yes. And it supported that myth that she was this wonderful, intrepid, brave woman. Whether she was entirely, we don't know. But we do know, obviously, that, I mean, she was a human being, and there are moments where she actually admits that that she's not feeling so brave.
And the truth of the matter was, she was selling a lot of paintings, and she was really quite dogged about badgering people in order to hold exhibitions. I mean, she wasn't lily livered about this, you know. She was probably just as good a saleswoman in terms of selling her paintings, as she was a writer of her exploits in the newspapers.
Well, certainly, Christine, as a painter, she was incredibly prolific. Is that part of the reason she's never been taken entirely seriously as an artist, a case of quantity over quality?
No, I don't think it's that. A lot of the paintings, of course, were... She made copies of quite a lot, and in fact, quite a lot of the paintings around nowadays, it's actually quite difficult to tell which are originals and which are copies.
So she made copies of her own paintings?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
There is, for example, a painting of hers in the museum in Queensland and an identical painting in the National Library in Canberra. Now, one of them is obviously a copy. I think, which one is the copy, because I counted the petals on them, and one of them has fewer petals than the other, and I suspect that that's the copy, but I'm not going to say which one.
Well, the extraordinary thing is that even by the age of 70, she's still travelling, and she's travelling in the jungles of New Guinea, still pursuing and painting flowers as well as birds and insects, even though she had recurring malaria. She died then in 1922 at the age of 74. Michael, what would you say her importance and contribution is as a painter of wildflowers? What's her legacy?
Well, her physical legacy is 970 paintings of the most exquisite watercolours that are lying in drawers in the National Library in Canberra that have hardly seen the light of day since she died. Her other legacy, I think, is that if global warming continues the way that it is, very soon her wonderful paintings are probably going to be all we have left to remember a lot of Australia's wonderful plant species. I mean, already in the 200 or so years since European settlement, at least 76 plant species have become extinct, and there are currently more than 300 at serious risk. Now, at the rate at which they're disappearing, that's all, you know, that we may have left to remember them by. And the sad thing is that here's this enormous collection, which I have to say is the single largest collection of art by any one artist in any institution anywhere in the world. And that in itself is a huge legacy. Very few people realise that it's there. People go to the National Library, they go to the bookshop where, as you come in the door, they are able to buy wonderful greeting cards with Ellis's paintings on them and bookmarks and all sorts of ephemera like that. And few people realise that all you've got to do is to get in the lift and go up to the second floor to the picture department and ask to see them, and they'll show them to you. But few people realise that they're there.
Which is one of the reasons why we wrote the book.
To alert people to the fact that they are there, and hopefully to revive some interest in a woman who is really, I think, an important part of Australia's early history. She's all but forgotten, and she shouldn't be.
Christine and Michael Morton Evans are the co-authors of The Flower Hunter, The Remarkable Life of Ellis Rowan. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Christine and Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amanda.
And if you want to see some of the paintings of Ellis Rowan, the National Library of Australia's collection is online. There's heaps of her paintings there, and they're all really well annotated. And there's a link to that site on our website, as well as details of the new biography, The Flower Hunter. abc.net.au/rn/artworks. I'm Amanda Smith, and this is ABC Radio National. And coming up in Artworks now, Isms in Art, our next instalment. And the artistic ism today goes into the performing arts rather than the visual arts, where we've mostly been, and into a strain that runs through the theatre of the 20th century and into the present day. It's political activism. And here's the performer and director, Maud Davey, with her take on it.
Art is a weapon. That was the motto of the New Theatre in Sydney, which was founded in 1932, and it was emblazoned on a banner and it was hung across the proscenium. The first political theatre that I was ever involved in was in Perth in the very early 80s. Desperate Measures was the Fremantle Radical Performance Group, and they did shows called Kiss Your Arsenal Goodbye and things like that. They asked me to devise and perform in a show to celebrate the anniversary of the women's electoral lobby, the Well Show. We said, well, 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 a lot. And we sang songs like Not going to the chapel and we're not going to get married. There were even tampon jokes. We thought we were very clever. Unbeknownst to me, I was a very naive 20-year-old, this kind of activity was a re-emergence of what had been going on in the 30s. Artists who were disillusioned with the mainstream left, forming groups that were quite closely tied to local Communist Party chapters, I didn't know that at the time, and creating performance that advocated for political and social change. The Well Show, Well, 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 was pretty typical agitprop theatre of the time. Agitprop is a contraction of the Russian words, my pronunciation here is terrible, agitatsiya and propaganda. And it emerged in the Soviet Union on the heels of the workers' revolution. So this was the 20s, and in the context of the Great Depression, artists became very politicised, and agitprop spread throughout the West, becoming agitprop theatre. And it rejected all the theatrical conventions of the time. It embraced the class struggle. It talked to working people in their own vernacular, and it was performed where the people were, on the streets, in pubs and workplaces and public gathering spaces. And mostly it was made up of short sketches, and it was direct, overt, it was often funny, and it was pretty rough.
Why are you so angry? Do you want to hang?
It was out of the agitprop theatre movement that that artists like Brecht emerged and began to develop their particular kind of much more sophisticated theatre. And that was in response to the rising threat of fascism, which kind of took precedence, if you like, over the struggle of the working class. And so people moved back inside the theatres and developed more sophisticated platforms for political discussion. Gradually the term agitprop came to describe any sort of highly political leftist theatre, and eventually, of course, it became a byword for unsophisticated, heavy-handed sloganeering with little or no artistic merit. The backdrop to the emergence of the modern political theatres in Australia was, of course, the cultural nationalism movement that was really hitting its straps in the late 60s, early 70s. These, of course, were the halcyon days of expanding government funding, and it was then that the foundations of the professional theatre industry, as we know it now, were laid down. Companies of artists like the Australian Performing Group, the APG, came together to create an Australian theatre that spoke in Australian accents and told Australian stories. And they were, you know, rubbing up against the new circus movement. It wasn't very hard to be political back then. I remember seeing Circus Oz for the first time, and I remember how thrilling it was to hear them say, "This is Circus Oz and you are on Aboriginal land." In Brisbane, there was the Popular Theatre Troupe, which formed in 1974. It was the first of the modern political theatre groups. And, of course, it makes sense that it was in Brisbane because, well, political theatre derives energy from opposition to very conservative governments, and these were the dark days of the Bjelke-Petersen reign. And then in Victoria in the late 70s, early 80s, there was the explosion of community theatre companies, which was driven by graduates from the new drama school at the Victorian College of the Arts. In Sydney, my sister Annie became a member of the Death Defying Theatre Ensemble, which was an outdoor performance group in the mid-80s. They made classic agitprop theatre. They performed outdoors, it was popular, it was accessible, it spoke to ordinary people. It was anything but deadly, boring old theatre speaking in somebody else's accents about somebody else's problems to middle-class people who came away confirmed in their prejudices and aspirations. Annie told me that they went to WAPA, the Academy of Performing Arts in Perth, and one of the students challenged them, saying, "Oh, look at you, you're a community theatre cliché with your colourful clothes and your funny hats." Because, of course, by that time, changing the world through theatre was going out of fashion. Maybe it was the federal Labor government, maybe it was just the whole greed is good thing, but those WAPA kids wanted to be Mel Gibson and go to Hollywood. And some of them did. Annie joined Circus Oz and travelled the world. At the tail end of this period, Patricia Cornelius, Michael White and Steve Payne came together to form Melbourne Workers Theatre. It was in 87. They wanted to make theatre that was thoroughly informed by workers, that wasn't simply propagandist, that was complex and moving and which gave voices to people who had none. But at the same time, this was the late 80s, funding had started to contract, which it did throughout the 90s. Gradually, the term community theatre came to describe any sort of highly political leftist theatre, and eventually it became a byword for unsophisticated, heavy-handed, humourless plays with little or no artistic merit. Jeff Kennett won the Victorian election, and John Howard won the federal election. The political theatres had to transform. To regain their traction, it wasn't enough to be popular, you had to be innovative. It wasn't enough to have big audiences who would never otherwise see theatre, you had to be excellent. It wasn't enough to make great shows, you had to make great business plans. Companies were going down, and there were ways in which work that was directly critical of the government was discouraged. It became the norm that companies lie low and remain silent for fear of losing their funding. So in this environment, most politically motivated theatre is being generated by independent groups on project funding because it's them who don't feel so beholden. And that means that they're able to be responsive, they're able to identify the injustices of the day, and they're able to talk about them when they're still current. What I'm interested in now is how we're going to respond to the new Labor government. Because, of course, with Kevin 07, all the political commentaries on the slate for production in 2008 and 2009, they've suddenly lost their currency. In the new government's honeymoon period, which is just winding up now, all that political stuff feels so last year. You know, to observe that nothing's changed in terms of border control, that little's changed in terms of the country's toadying relationship with the US, that the intervention is still going on in the Northern Territory, and that nothing's changed about politicians wading into arguments about censorship with ill-thought-out pronouncements, it just doesn't play well. You know, nobody wants to look like yesterday's man, do they? Knock, knock. Who's there? John Howard. John Howard who?
A knock-knock joke in artworks, how about that? Maude Davey is an actor and writer and director, and she's currently the artistic director of the Melbourne Workers Theatre. She's also appearing next month in a new Melbourne season of The Burlesque Hour. And another artistic ism for you again next week here in Artworks. Amanda Smith with you on ABC Radio National. Now, I want to talk to you about poetry. Do you think it's sometimes easier to hear the rhythm of a poem when it's read out loud to you rather than reading it silently to yourself? Could it be that poetry best finds its way into your heart and mind by way of the ear? There's no doubt that performance poets are very popular at writers' festivals, and maybe this is why. The Byron Bay Writers' Festival is an annual event at this time of year, held outdoors in that gorgeous part of the country. And this is a panel of diverse performance poets from the festival last year, with Lynn Gallagher hosting. From Indonesia, there's Laxmi Pamunjak. From Singapore, Yung Soo Hung. And Chicago-born, Australian-based Miles Merrill. As well as being from very different places and backgrounds, each of these poets takes us on a very different emotional journey with the poems they're performing here, beginning with Laxmi Pamunjak.
This was written in 2004, and it actually spoke to a period in my daughter's life. She was born with cleft palate, and so the first 2 years of her life was a very trying one, and also a very trying one for us, for the parents, because she had corrective surgery at the age of 1.5, and this is the experience that I necessarily have to relate about her surgery. And it's called By the Recovery Room. Pounding and hammering on the slate-grey door, hacking, gouging, trashing with the painter's hands, pulling at the handle until her nails break one by one. People gawking, whispering, sidling to the other side of the hallway, doctors, nurses, people in uniform, mumbling, "Here goes another," and keeping on, just keeping on. Someone saying, signalling, "You are not supposed to be here. Go over and wait by the recovery room." But this is by the recovery room, and our baby is crying. She's only 2, and they've stitched up the roof of her mouth 4 hours under the knife, and she's already crying. It'll pry her apart, and she's only 2. Somebody do something. But the slate-grey door does not budge. Looking down at her broken nails, she says, "This is for each quart of blood we have to pump into her." But our baby is crying. "This is for each gasp of oxygen." An imaginary slit showing a baby bruised by tears, contorted, deformed, blood creeping out from the creaks of her jaw to her body, too white, too tiny for such an assault. Those muscles, they're so young, so flimsy, they won't hold together. But what sort of parents are you to have let this happen? And then that terrible silence in the dark, in someone else's arms. Our baby is crying. But between her and the surgery room, the door has no more word, not even the maiden Artemis with 3 faces, only moth floating in the door light, and our baby, not crying.
Laxmi Pamunjak reading from her heart-wrenching poem By the Recovery Room. The next speaker in this lineup of contemporary performance poets is a totally different artist. His name is Yung Soo Hung, and he fell into poetry accidentally, or so he says. His book Frottage won the 2006 Singapore Literature Prize, but he's a computer scientist who describes his poetics as having had a dot-com period. Yung Soo Hung, as you'll hear, is a man of many identities.
There's actually a poem in different parts about Ned Kelly, I don't think I need to explain who Ned Kelly is, because he's such a legend here. Even though when I do my readings in Singapore or elsewhere, I might have to.
I love it that you're taking the legend of Ned Kelly to Singapore. I think it's great.
Well, what happened was that I was looking at a series of Sidney Nolan paintings on Ned Kelly in a gallery in New Zealand. And then I decided to write a series of poems to talk about this Ned Kelly story. And I realized that I wasn't bringing anything new to this legend. And then I sort of threw the whole thing away and started writing a series of conversations instead. So it was almost like I was having a conversation with Ned Kelly. And you know how Singapore is in terms of maintaining law and order. And I just thought that it might be interesting. So I'll just read you part 2, 3, and 4. Part 2 of Conversations with an Outlaw. Ned, you're the anti-hero we never had, but wish to hold out for. Though the catch is we still have the death penalty and the Internal Security Act. But firstly, what reforms would you advocate if you were here as foreign talent? Would you be a rook trader messing with virtual liquidity, or a consultant calling for deregulation of banks? Would you write articles critical of our government, or settle down as PR and steal our wives? Sure, our women would fall for you if you look anything like Heath Ledger or an Olympic swimmer with oversized feet. Ned, are you metrosexual? I wonder what you'd look like if you wax and shave. Clean cut, you could be our Australian idol and woo us with your songs. Such is Life could be the title of your first single to break into our radio charts. Life could be good when you're forever 25, with an extended shelf life of Booker Prize text and Snapcase merchandise. 3. Tell me a good secret, Ned. Tell me, when will Australia become truly Asian? Tell me what you think of the free trade agreement and the philosophy of Pauline Hanson. Have you ever come across Komodo dragons while trekking the outback? Tell me, has Australia become American? Would you fight someone else's war in Iraq just as you had fought against oppression in your own backyard? Have you made up your mind, or are you still about to brandish a protest banner on a corner of Queen Street Mall? Tell me if you had always wanted a real bulletproof vest. 4. This is the last part that I'm going to read. I will tell you, Ned, I do not understand Australian rules. I will tell you how much of my father's savings I had lost on roulette when I was supposed to be in school. I will tell you which Malaysian restaurants are faking it. I will count the number of kangaroos I had road killed on my way to the Grampians. I will tell you which of my Asian classmates is working part-time as a prostitute. And when I get to know you better, we can figure out why Bali is overrun by Australians, while Surfer's Paradise is teeming with Japanese tourists constantly turning for an equal bund. Thank you.
Yung Soo Hoong reading from his Ned Kelly poems. This is Artworks on ABC Radio National. I'm Lynn Gallagher, and this is the Byron Bay Writers Festival, where three different performance poets are showing us how their writing works. The third is Miles Merrill, who's been described as Australia's spoken word tour de force. He was born in Chicago and has released a number of CDs, written and performed his own solo shows, and last year created a series of poetry slams for all the state libraries around Australia.
I actually feel that poetry was originally created to be spoken out loud and was originally created as spells to have a effect on the world, to be able to transform your environment, and rhythm is a great part of that. They're like little keys that you can use to unlock the imagination. This one is one that was commissioned last year to perform at the Opera House as a part of a show called Lamppost Incantations. And it's based on an experience of, I suppose, being in love with someone who decided to leave me for an ex. who, strangely enough, and this doesn't say very much for me, I suppose, who was, strangely enough, he was living in his grandmother's basement, hooked on heroin, collecting mental disability, and his wife and kids had just left him. But hey, I said good luck, and see how you go. Anyway, his surname was Nightingale. It's called Flying Triangle. You know how crows and so-called carrion birds pick out your muscles when you die. Carry your heart across a meat pink sky. Well, my girl's mind was stole out by a nightingale. Like a reverse Medusa, she used to melt everything in her circle of sight. I tell you, I've seen gray lumps of concrete clinging to her feet, moaning, "Well, I was trying to be a cold, hard footpath till you walked over me." Yet this nightingale, he stays stoned. Granted, she is a raven, beaked and black, full of tears and caws. She got shot from the, knocked from the, clipped her ass out of the migrating flock, used to soar north looking for sun-baked climes. This nightingale, he a junk man. And I ain't talking 6:30 Monday morning, pick up your trash, wake your ass up. And I ain't talking no Bondi junk shunned after a Thursday night mall psycho spend, cut that card up. I ain't talking, I'm a singer, I sing, puppy, puppy, pup. Headstone holes, pop, needle-sized shovels, pop, digging poor graves, pop that taut milk skin, he popped that needle in his swollen elbow, drop, pop. They moved, raven and nightingale, Sydney, South Coast, the quiet he hunted, the hiding she needed among leaves in a dying garden, fruit trees all blown, grass snaky, overgrown. So, how high was he? Staked out every grocery store, the gong to Helensburg, buy up all the bags of poppy seeds, tell him, "Order me more." Take home, boil, siphon down to a nasty brown gel. Mix with red cordial and sip through the day from a dirty Fanta bottle. A drink looks like he dropped a tube of blood and water. "Poppy wash. Keeps me regular," he says. So how crazy was he? "You see that dude over there?"
"Where?"
"Over there in the park, taking pictures of us."
"I don't see anybody."
"Just look. You want to know why he's taking pictures of us?"
"Why?"
"'Cause some punk on the street must have given him my name. I stopped going to the city, mate. It came to a head, fully to a head. One night, me and your ex, watching gypsy stuff at the basement, fully 23 undercovers."
"Whoa, undercovers? You mean agents? What were they doing there?"
"Scoping me out." "I stopped going to the city, mate. It came to a head, fully."
"So how much did he love her?"
"I got this, pull away. She comes closer, trick down. She's studying how to tame horses, right? She don't even see. I'm whispering her. I'm holding the bit. Raven steps in, mouth first. You want to know the truth? I think she still loves you, mate. But I'm not going to let her go. Long as I got money for my ex-wife, my house, my family. Besides, I'm standing behind the yellow line, aren't I?
I am a robin. Not a robin the cradle, robin the archer, robin the Williams, just a plain old puff chest, red breast, feathered creature. A robin who fell for a raven. She left me for a nightingale. She says they can sing. She says they can sing together. She says she wants some street in her garden. She says she wants his name. And I say, no names. We don't have names. Not like you, Tom, Sue. My name goes like this. Him, he uses two. Raven's name is... But as I say, him, he uses two. He calls himself in a tone like a train breaking, like a TV tone telling you, wake up, show's over. But you want to know his real name? Do you want to know his real name? It's lonely, but kind of mesmerizing, hey? Thanks.
Now, I'd like to just take a vote from the audience. Is that a poem or a spell? Is it a poem or an incantation? But while I let you contemplate that curly question, I'll put another one to the panel. It's just came to my attention the other day that a civil rights organisation in Detroit tried to bury the word nigger. And aside from whether or not you can actually bury a word, they couldn't outlaw it because it was a violation of the First Amendment, but they tried to bury it because they didn't want people to use it anymore. It's a very ugly word. And in one way, you're just drawing attention to a word if you try and bury it. You're layering it with extra meanings and so on. But leaving all that aside, the question that it raised for me was, it's a word that's actually used a lot in poetics. And even though it's an ugly word, it may have a kind of rap-like rhythm. So I'm going to play a CD. This is American poet, Black, New York, and he is, it only goes for about 2 minutes, he's using the word nigger in a performance piece that he did at the Melbourne Festival last year. His name is Sekou Sundiata. So just have a listen to this and see what you think about whether or not we should bury the word nigger.
A nigger with multiple affiliations. A nigger that's tied to everything and tied to nothing at the same time. A nigger without a flag. A nigger with the right attitude. A jellyback nigger without a spine. A nigger with a disagreement. A curry nigger next to a chutney nigger next to the nigger next door. A nigger with a funny way of thinking. Yo nigger, my nigger, this nigger, that nigger. The first nigger to be the first nigger to be the first nigger to be the last one to know. The nigger with that nigger feeling. Nigger, please. Pyramid type nigger. With a Back to Africa tattoo on her arm. An old school nigga with a razor. A nigga with a grocery store, a laundry, and a check cashing place. A nigga in short supply. A nigga in nigga recovery. A nigga with jokes. A smart nigga with a pass. A biracial nigga with a Jones for bean pies. A nigga with a SWAT sticker painted on his car door. Yo nigga, my nigga, this nigga, that nigga. The first nigga to be the first nigga to be the last one to know. The nigga with that nigga feeling. Nigga, please. A nigger, postmodern nigger, dropping quotes without the quotation marks. The nigger sitting on your car when you come out the restaurant looking at you like you a punk, like what? A hippity-hoppity nigger speaking French and drinking Zinfandel. A nigger with 1 foot in a refugee camp and 1 foot on Wall Street. The nigger sitting on your car when you come out the restaurant looking at you like you a punk, like what? A nigga with a song singing sin, no sign of redemption, nowhere, just the truth pants down in a cold wind. A goddess punched and dragged on top of a pool table. That nigga raped. Hundreds of niggas inside the school running out, 2 more niggas inside shooting niggas like they was niggas. Country niggas, Midwest niggas, Polish niggas, Jewish niggas, Soy Dominicano niggas, Christian niggas, Hollywood niggas, uniform niggas, a nigga in a fundamental sense, a seed to shine and see, nigga. Yo, nigga. My nigga, this nigga, that nigga. The first nigga to be 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 the first nigga, the first nigga to be the first nigga, the first nigga to be the first nigga to be the first nigga to be the last one to know. The nigga with that nigga feeling. Nigga, please.
Okay, kind of a hard word to outlaw, but what do you, I'm going to point the finger at Miles because he uses that word in some of his poetry. So what are you able to respond to that?
Yeah, I think the more you use a word, the less it means, really.
And is that what he's trying to do?
I think so, yeah. I think even Lenny Bruce had that in one of his sketches where he just said, nigga, 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 nigga. And he said, as you say it, it just, you know, it takes away meaning. And if you were, and if you said it as though it was casual, then a Black kid on his way to school on a Saturday morning, or on a weekday morning,
wouldn't be so hurt by it, because I think it would just be, you know, it would just be a simple thing. It would be something that all of us can go, all right, well, whatever, it doesn't mean anything, you know.
Okay, then the follow-up question is, can a word be have a horrible meaning and a beautiful sound?
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, cellar
and
door.
And is nigger an example, perhaps?
I don't think it's just spoken for the sound. I don't know if it has a particularly horrible meaning when it's applied to everybody as well as black people. And I think that poem that we just heard, it means that. That, you know, and my father actually used to say that anybody can be a nigger. It's an attitude, to more of an attitude than a race or a nationality.
It's just a thought. Who determines meaning? I mean, this might have some resonance in my culture, in my history, for instance. The word Jap, for instance, for Japanese, seems to be quite derogatory. And then the word China, which can encompass anything from a person from China, can also be Chineseness, can also be the Chinese language. For a long time, under the very repressive Suharto administration, which only ended in 1998, in which we suddenly got a new leash on life and freedom and so on of expression, it was seen to be a very, very wrong thing to say. And what a lot of Indonesians of Chinese descent are trying to do now is to reinvest it with a meaning which is not one that was imposed by the Suharto administration, but something that can actually resurrect some kind of pride in being Chineseness, because it is like boundaries. It's how people draw boundaries on geography and decide on where people stand. China. And for the longest time, people of Chinese descent were encouraged to say Tionghua rather than China. China has a very, very bad connotation. But, I mean, China can be very, very poetic.
Yeah. Is there anyone else?
Actually, I just want to add on, if I may. We seem to be talking about certain words that might offend certain people. And I feel that when we're talking about rhythm or the music of poetry and so on, there are actually many other words that we could choose from.
That's true.
So there's actually no need to think about certain words that might have a certain negative feeling that might sound good. And in fact, I would even like to say that all words would sound nice if used in a certain way. And it has to do with how certain lines are being broken up and how you read a passage. So it's not so much in terms of what words you use, but in the context that you use the words.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, now I'm going to head towards winding this session up, and I'm going to put Miles again on the spot. You were telling me earlier about your rap version of Coleridge. Can you just tell the audience a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I tour to schools, and I talk to them about how the poems that they read in schools, that they were originally meant to be spoken aloud, and that they all have a particular rhythm to them. And then I do a damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song to such a deep delight would win me that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honey dew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise, and drunk the milk of paradise.
Rapping on Kubla Khan, Miles Merrill, along with fellow performance poets Yung Soo Hung and Lakshmi Pamunjak, at a session with Lynn Gallagher at the Byron Bay Writers' Festival last year. This year's festival has just happened. Now, for anything you've heard in artworks today, you can check out the website for details and links. There's also a transcript of today's Ism in Art for you. And in fact, all the isms in art to date are there at abc.net.au/rn/artworks. Executive producer for Artworks is Lynn Gallagher, and I'm Amanda Smith. Thank you. This is Artworks, Amanda Smith with you on ABC Radio National. Continuing our feature series on classic art books of the 20th century, books that have helped shape the way we look at and think about art. Today it's one of the world's most famous art critics, Robert Hughes, and his best-known book, Shock of the New. Here's Julie Copeland.
Although he left Australia 40 years ago, Hughes is so well known here he hardly needs introduction. Time magazine's art critic for over 30 years, he's also written a range of books, beginning with A History of Australian Art, tributes to artists Lucian Freud and Goya, and to the city of Barcelona, plus books from his TV histories of modern art and of American art, Shock of the New and American Visions. In between, there was The Fatal Shore, Hughes' epic chronicle of the colonisation of Australia. Plus his terrifically entertaining, polemical books of essays, Nothing If Not Critical, and a scathing attack on the decay of US culture titled The Culture of Complaint. Like Australia's other favourite public intellectuals, Robert Hughes is an expat, whose near-fatal car crash here a few years ago exacerbated his already uncomfortable relationship with this country. So perhaps when he settled in New York back in the early 70s, he found just the right place at the right time, at the height of the New York art scene, where he developed the opinionated, pugnacious wit which characterises his writing and TV style.
I've always thought if Robert Hughes was a painting, he would be this sort of massive craggy rock with sort of waves crashing against it, and would be a blustery sky, and bats would be coming off it, and it would all be sort of dark and brooding and moody, and then down right at the very bottom of the painting there would be a big rock that had crushed an artist who had been painting a sort of landscape. Because he's like that. There's a certain kind of boisterous temper within what he talks about, what he thinks, what he writes. It's kind of eloquent, it's very romantic, but it's often very sort of devastating.
I think the really important thing about Robert Hughes, I mean, he can be awfully overbearing and pompous and all those things, and he's very good at putting people offside. But basically his real importance is as a popularizer, in the best sense of the word. A popularizer in the way that, say, Kenneth Clark was or Leonard Bernstein. That is, someone who can talk about art without dumbing down, without patronizing. And that's a rare skill.
This series, The Shock of the New, is about an old subject, almost 100 years old. The art of our own century, modernism. Now, in culture, centuries don't start neatly on cue. Ours didn't. It began round about 1880, and it's finishing up its run now, leaving behind it, in my view, some of the most challenging, beautiful, and intelligent works of art that have ever been made, along with a great mass of superfluity and rubbish. Now, I don't want to do a history of modern art. Instead, I want to evoke its spirit by showing how it's acted upon society and vice versa. How it's dealt, for instance, with the idea of pleasure. How it has tried to confirm or reject the political status quo. How it's tried to construct utopias, and so on.
The opening episode of Robert Hughes' series Shock of the New, on American public TV in 1979. Before that, to Australian contemporary art voices, curator Juliana Endberg and arts writer and historian Peter Timms. And although every Hughes reader has a favourite book, along with Peter Timms, mine is Barcelona, undeniably it's The Shock of the New, his eight-part account of the rise and fall of modern art, which made Hughes not just the leading visual arts critic, but a household name. Hughes has famously declared that no artwork can compete with the impact of newspapers and TV culture. But he's always prided himself on his ability to communicate with the widest possible audience, and he knew that TV was the place to find it. Perhaps the nearest present-day equivalent is the British TV arts personality and commentator Matthew Collings, he of the BBC's This Is Modern Art series, which you may have seen here on ABC TV a few years ago. And when Matthew Collings was in Brisbane recently, he joined me from the Brizzy ABC studio to assess Robert Hughes.
Well, I think it's fair enough to call him the world's most famous because he's got his platform with Time magazine, or at least he did have. But I think what else makes him distinguished amongst sort of art critics who gear what they have to say to a popular audience is his seriousness and his originality. So he's not a populist in the sense of dumbing things down. He wants to intelligent up the audience. He thinks culture should be something improving, something marvellous, and something sort of that sweeps you off your feet and is worth aspiring to.
Well, he was particularly vitriolic, I think, in his attacks during the 1980s when he looked at, the likes of Julian Schnabel and Jeff Koons, who, as he said, saw art as being about money and hype. And he was particularly nasty about Julian Schnabel, I seem to remember. He said something like, "Our time of insecure self-congratulation and bulimic vulgarity got the genius it deserved."
Yes. Now you've hit the point where actually I start to disagree with him. I think that Schnabel isn't nearly as bad as Hughes thinks. And I think a lot of the artists that Hughes has kind of forced himself to support in order to make his case are not as good as Hughes thinks. I think that Sean Scully and Paul Arago and Lucian Freud are all slightly tedious, actually. And although Schnabel may be a bit up and down, he's a much more adventurous figure than any of those three. But nevertheless, I think what Hughes is pointing at generally, and using Koons as an example of, and even Schnabel as an example, both of whom, by the way, have done some pretty extraordinary things, what he's pointing at generally is a correct target. Hughes is right to say that something has gone wrong. As art has become more and more popular, it's stopped really being art. And there's a bit of a line between unpopular art, which has a sort of richness to it, and popular art, which no longer has any richness. If it's popular, what's the point of it being popular if there's nothing really there?
Mm. If I just ask you to sum up more or less what was the impact and what was the effect of Shock of the New, both the television series and the book, in terms of its scope. You know, it was covering the whole rise and fall of modernism in the 20th century. It's huge. But what kind of impression did it have on you in terms of what it was saying?
Well, you know, they're two different things, the TV series and the book. The book, you can read it and read it. So there's a lot of good stuff in there. I would say that what's happening with the TV series is the achievement there is that he's making a very complicated story into something that will work in a medium that favours simplicity. So to be able to do that is a marvellous thing. And when you say, what impact did it have on me? Well, it was just like watching TV. You know, you don't really think of TV as having an impact. You just watch it and you find it enjoyable or not. But when I now put the things together, when I think about that book and the TV programme, I think what's great about what Hughes did was that he took an already established story, which is the story of the isms of modern art, and he made it into a gripping narrative. But that narrative wasn't just gripping because of some abstract ability he had to make a story, but because he had high aspirations. He gave you the feeling that he was genuinely depressed about the noble aspirations of art no longer being there, that they had somehow been lost, that the moment of modernism had passed. And he made you feel that that thing that was lost was a tragic loss. And he found a voice to express that so that you could take it seriously. He wasn't a fuddy-duddy, he wasn't an academic. And as I say, he made that idea of modern art as something important that was essential and that we needed. He made the passing of it seem like a loss.
By the end of the war, the entire world knew what had been done in the death camps of Nazi Germany, and there was no testimony that art could give that could rival the evidence of the photograph. Today, places like Dachau are their own monuments, but any distortion of the human body that an artist might make after 1945 was going to have to bear comparison with what the Nazis had done to real bodies, and very few expressionist paintings could stand this strain. What we understand about the Holocaust, we get from writing and photography. But art had very little to contribute, almost nothing of importance. The effects of this failure are still with us, because after the war, there were very few people who believed that art could carry the burden of major social meanings anymore. There would be no more Goyas and Corbeys. In the death camps, the only product, as far as art was concerned, was silence.
the stentorian tones of Robert Hughes from his now legendary TV series The Shock of the New. And while the Australian-born art critic admired the greatest artist of death and suffering, Goya, and Courbet, he once quipped, "A Gustave Courbet portrait of a trout has more death in it than Rubens could get in a whole crucifixion." And on ABC Radio National, I'm talking about Robert Hughes with UK arts writer and commentator Matthew Collings.
A conservative document, whereas neoconservatives thought that I was being far too easy on the left.
Well, before we talk about his persona on television and what kind of a TV arts critic he is, I think it was one of the American critics said that Robert Hughes is the only critic, the only art critic, who had that precise and vivacious elegance that Kenneth Tynan, the great theatre critic. And, of course, he's been compared to Hughes with the likes of Kenneth Clark and Simon Sharma. But in terms of the style, I mean, he's also impressive in the way he's able to write across different audiences. I mean, he said somewhere he likes to write short articles and long books, and that's why he's not at The New Yorker but at Time magazine for 30 years.
Yeah.
And prides himself on having the widest possible audience that he has with Time. But then he can write quite serious books about art. His book on Goya, for example.
Yes, I would say he's a brilliant journalist. I wouldn't say that he was a very original intellectual. And I don't think he would hate me, I hope, for saying that. I would say that he's the absolute top class of journalism. And, some of those other names you mentioned, Kenneth Tynan is very good for coming up with original perceptions. I think Simon Sharma is maybe a little bit more verbose than Hughes. I think Simon Sharma actually lacks the journalistic gifts that Hughes has. But in a way, what Hughes did was invent by himself, through his own originality and his own gifts, mixed with the circumstances as he found them in the New York art world in 1970 when he moved there, a new sort of tough journalistic populist style of art criticism. And he made that thing the popular style of art criticism, which is really rather a ropey thing, which on the whole doesn't have much going for it. He made it into something worth having. He elevated a low style into a high style. But it certainly isn't academic what he comes up with. And it may be that some of the recent scholarship on Goya, for example, is more interesting and surprising and insightful and helpful about Goya than Hughes' recent book on Goya. But none of them are as entertaining because Hughes has that journalistic flair. And he can make the story of Goya a good read. You want to read that book like you want to read a novel. Whereas, Janice Tomlinson, who's the absolutely fantastic academic, who's the Goya specialist, who I'm sure Hughes has read everything she's ever written, will give you much more insightful but maybe more difficult ideas about Goya, which take a little while to digest and work out. She hasn't quite got that flair for narrative that Hughes has.
Pollock was the first American artist to influence the course of world art. For the last 10 years of his life, until he died in a car crash in 1956, he lived and worked on Long Island outside New York.
My painting is direct. I usually paint on the floor. I enjoy working on a large canvas. I feel more at home, more at ease in a big area. I like to use a dripping, fluid paint. I want to express my feelings rather than illustrate them.
Pollock's drip technique used to be treated as a joke, as though he were out of control. But he wasn't. The drips of paint were spontaneous, but they fell just where he wanted them, building the surface into a web of skeins and subtle energies working across the whole canvas. Pollock once declared that he wanted to become nature. What did he mean? That he wanted to work parallel with its variety, its unpredictability, and above all, its vitality. He had a very light hand. Sometimes, as in Blue Poles, you might be looking at a sort of abstract Tiepolo, the same kind of airy, light and sprightly drawing. This nervous energy of Pollock's, expanding under strict control, seems to refute the picture of him as a rip-roaring wildcatter from Middle America. Only intelligence, allied to a deep sense of the natural world, can produce work like this.
Again, and I'm quoting another reviewer of one of Robert Hughes' works, saying that to read a Hughes commentary on a painting is to feel that it's hanging in your mind's eye, perfectly lit for inspection. Well, I'm interested to ask you, Matthew Collings, as someone who's also presented more recent television programmes on contemporary art and modern art, how would you describe his style on television?
Well, he's a compelling figure on TV, and I think I make a sort of act out of doubt a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a much more Hemingway-esque
Absolutely.
Guy.
Who no self-doubt there doubts. At all. No, yeah. not a one.
Yeah, so I don't always believe what he's saying. Recently on TV, I feel that he's not quite all there, and that he's kind of being told what to say by the producers sometimes. Mm. You know, one of the problems with doing these sort of authored TV docos is to fight to control your material. And in some ways, he may have slightly given up that fight, I feel.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that's actually the case. You know, I absolutely don't know. But the impression I get is that The Shock of the New is much more convincing as somebody's ideas than his series about Australia a few years ago, you know. The Australians were all fed up with him for being anti-Australia, but I was fed up with him for not really being anything. I couldn't understand what on earth he was saying in that series, just sort of rambling from one thing to another, really.
Well, that was, of course, after his car crash, the terrible accident.
Which was indeed terrible, absolutely awful, yeah.
So it's a combination of things, I think, that's led to that falling out with Australia that you mentioned before.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as far as I can see, you know, to sum it up, he seems to have... His feelings were kind of hurt, you know, and he lashed out for a public figure in a way that he couldn't really afford to do, and he was kind of destroyed for that lashing out, I think. And I think that's a shame, you know, the state of contemporary art internationally now, and Australia's absolutely no exception to this, is so lamentable. You know, it's the same everywhere. So, you know, Australia's is just as advanced as New York or Cologne, actually. It's not provincial at all. But the whole thing is so ghastly that you really need a Robert Hughes. You need him thundering against it.
Yeah.
And so it's a shame to chuck him out just because, you know, he got a bit cross and said some unfortunate things.
Yes, well, again, it's interesting if you go back to his book, The Culture of Complaint.
Yeah, it's a very
If we go back to the writing rather than television, you know, he's talking about the whole notion of an avant-garde existing in art is a fallacy anyway.
Yeah.
And that,
well, it doesn't exist now, he says.
Well, he's talking about the United States mostly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that there could be an innovative artist or group struggling against an entrenched establishment, which is the old idea of the avant-garde, is now dead. What do you make of that?
Well, I absolutely agree, of course, you know, and it's not really anything that anyone could disagree with. What an avant-garde is, what it means is the opposite to the salon, to the official art. It's slightly ahead of official art and it's against official art. And you've got, broadly, you've got an idea of culture is innovative and is trying to push society along to advance itself and to progress and to be less conservative. But what you've got now is a pseudo avant-garde that's absolutely one with the shallow aims of society and is absolutely willing to do whatever rubbish society wants. And he's quite right to deplore that and to feel nostalgic for lost values and angry about those lost values, and maybe sometimes to be even a little bit blustering and histrionic and narrow in his shoutings. I think he has a right to those foibles or to that slight weakness in his case against the present because he feels a sort of beleaguered guy. He's out there on his own. No one else will go along with him. But I'd like to sign up to his particular political party.
And even that's a bit confusing in Culture of Complaint when he's railing against the ideologues on the right and the left.
I'm not sure if it's really confusing. He says that the extreme right in America are ghastly and the PC brigade are ghastly too. And that seems to me fair enough.
And particularly art theoreticians or academics. There's a lovely story in Culture of Complaint where he's talking about driving through New York streets with several of America's most influential art theoreticians in the back. And he says, hopefully tongue-in-cheek, he may have been doing the art world a big favour had he run the car off the road.
Yeah. Well, you know, theory is something that is now done in the art world as part of careerism and power moves. And it's almost a sort of in some other ways, it's almost ornamental or decorative. You know, you cite a bit of theory speak that sounds important just in so that you can attach a theory flourish to whatever ghastly nondescript conceptual art object you want to put over on the public. But that's the misuse of theory within the art world, and that's what he's railing against. He doesn't pay much attention to real theory. You know, real theory is done by real theorists who are clever and spend their time doing theory and have made incredibly valuable contributions to civilization and to society and, you know, changes in the way that we think. What he's railing against is the misuse of theory by the art world and also by the literary world. It's what it's gradually degenerated into is the worst aspects of pop culture and the most obscure aspects of theory about pop culture seeming to be pretty much indistinguishable. They both seem as shallow as each other.
Mm.
And what you want high culture and art to do is to present a real alternative to mass pap. But whereas, in fact, what you're finding is high culture and art culture merging with mass pap.
That's right. I don't think he's got anything, he doesn't feel that strongly about mass pap or even television. It's bad television that he rails against, and also the fact that theorists would take something like mass culture like Madonna, commercial culture, seriously. You know, that he says that there's the Lacanian Madonna and the Freudian Madonna and the Marxist Madonna.
Yeah.
Who cares?
You know, Lacan and Freud, absolutely, these are brilliant minds. Madonna is, you know, brilliant within her area, but what's it got to do with anything? You know, it's a sort of pop phenomenon. It's got really nothing to do with high art.
Well, Matthew, it sounds like you still think art's worth talking about and responding to, because you picked up where Robert Hughes left off pretty well with your This Is Modern Art series. So what is it about for you?
I think it's not going to change the world politically, but I think this pleasure is a very complex notion, to sound a bit theoretical. But, you know, art offers a pleasure that is contemplative and important and serious and long-lasting. And as such, it is an alternative to all the other crap that makes up contemporary existence. And that alternative is badly needed. And at the moment, I would say one finds it more in modern art up to the 1950s and in pre-modern art than in contemporary art. So for me, as a critic, the job is to try and, I think, to make people aware of what art can really do, as opposed to the rather low-level, low-hum stuff that it is doing now.
Matthew Collings, a London-based arts writer, critic, presenter and artist. Thanks very much for speaking to me today about the art critic and writer Robert Hughes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Copeland with the artist and arts commentator Matthew Collings. He's also the frontman for BBC TV's telecast of the Turner Prize. And this artworks feature on the writer and critic Robert Hughes. Among his many books, Shock of the New is the one about art he's most famous for.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.